Chapter 5. Makum Sir Thomas on coming out of Clerkenwell. You are a naughty boy, Tom, but then, you know, we ought to love our brethren, though ever so naughty. We are moralists, and reprimand you, and you are hereby reprimanded accordingly. But in case England should ever have need of a few score thousand champions, who laugh at danger, who cope with giants, who, stricken to the ground, jump up and gaily rally, and fall, and rise again, and strike, and die rather than yield in case the country should need such men, and you should know them, be pleased to send lists of the misguided persons to the principal police stations, where means may someday be found to utilize their wretched powers, and give their deplorable energies a right direction. Suppose, Tom, that you and your friends are pitted against an immense invader. Suppose you are bent on holding the ground, and dying there, if need be. Suppose it is life, freedom, honor, home, you are fighting for, and there is a death-dealing sword or rifle in your hand, with which you are going to resist some tremendous enemy who challenges your championship on your native shore. Then, Sir Thomas, resist him to the death, and it is all right. Kill him, and heaven bless you. Drive him into the sea, and there destroy, smash, and drown him, and let us sing Laudamus. In these national cases, you see, we override the indisputable first laws of morals. Loving your neighbor is very well, but suppose your neighbor comes over from Calais and Bowlin to rob you of your laws, your liberties, your newspapers, your parliament, all of which some dear neighbors of ours have given up in the most self-denying manner, suppose any neighbor were to cross the water, and propose this kind of thing to us? Should we not be justified in humbly trying to pitch him into the water? If it were the King of Belgium himself, we must do so. I mean that fighting, of course, is wrong, but that there are occasions when, and see, I suppose I mean, that one-handed fight of Sayers is one of the most spirit-stirring little stories ever told, and, with every love and respect for morality, my spirit says to her, do, for goodness' sake, my dear madam, keep your true, and pure, and womanly, and gentle remarks for another day. Have the great kindness to stand a little aside, and just let us see one or two more rounds between the men. That little man with the one hand powerless on his breast facing yonder giant for hours, unfurling him to, every now and then. It is the little Java and the Constitution over again. I think it is a most fortunate event for the brave Heenan, who has acted and written since the battle with a true warrior's courtesy, and with a great deal of good logic too, that the battle was a drawn one. The advantage was all on Mr. Sayers' side. Say a young lad of 16 insults me in the street, and I try and thrash him, and do it. Well, I have thrashed a young lad. You great big tyrant, couldn't you hit one of your own size? But say the lad thrashes me? In either case I walk away discomfited. But in the latter, I am positively put to shame. Now, when the ropes were cut from that death grip, and Sir Thomas released, the gentleman of Benicia was confessedly blind of one eye, and speedily afterwards was blind of both. Could Mr. Savers have held out for 3 minutes, for 5 minutes, for 10 minutes more? He says he could. So we say we could have held out, and did, and had beaten off the enemy at Waterloo, even if the Prussians hadn't come up. The opinions differ pretty much according to the nature of the opponents. I say the Duke and Tom could have held out, that they meant to hold out, that they did hold out, and that there has been fistifying enough. That crowd which came in and stopped the fight ought to be considered like one of those divine clouds which the gods send in Homer. Apollo shrouds the godlike Trojan in a veil of clouds. It is the best way of getting the godlike Trojan out of the scrape, don't you see? The notice is cut. Tom is out of chancery. The Benicia boy not a bit the worse, nay, better than if he had beaten the little man. He has not the humiliation of conquest. He is greater, and will be loved more hereafter by the gentle sex. Suppose he had overcome the godlike Trojan? Suppose he had tied Tom's corpse to his cab wheels, and driven to Farnham, smoking the pipe of triumph? Fa, the great Hulkin conqueror. Why did you not hold your hand from yonder hero? Everybody, I say, was relieved by that opportune appearance of the British gods, protectors of native valor, who interfered, and it through their champion. Now, suppose 6'2" conqueror, and 5'8" beaten, would Sayers have been a whit the less gallant and meritorious? If Sancho had been allowed really to reign in Barataria, I make no doubt that, with his good sense and kindness of heart, he would have devised some means of rewarding the brave vanquished, as well as the brave victors in the Baratarian army, and that a champion who had fought a good fight would have been a knight of King Don Sancho's orders, whatever the upshot of the combat had been. Suppose Wellington overwhelmed on the plateau of Mont St. John. Suppose Washington attacked and beaten at Valley Forge, and either supposition is quite easy, and what becomes of the heroes? They would have been as brave, honest, heroic, wise, but their glory, where would it have been? Should we have had their portraits hanging in our chambers? Have been familiar with their histories? Have pondered over their letters, common lives, and daily sayings? There is not only merit, but luck which goes to making a hero out of a gentleman. Mind, please you, I am not saying that the hero is after all not so very heroic, and have not the least desire to grudge him his merit because of his good fortune. Have you any idea whither this roundabout essay on some late great victories is tending? Do you suppose that by those words I mean Trenton, Brandywine, Salamanca, Vitoria, and so forth? By a great victory I can't mean that affair at Farnham, for it was a drawn fight. Where, then, are the victories, pray, and when are we coming to them? My good sir, you will perceive that in this Nicaean discourse I have only as yet advanced as far as this, that a hero, whether he wins or loses, is a hero, and that if a fellow will but be honest and courageous, and do his best, we are for paying all honor to him. Furthermore, it has been asserted that fortune has a good deal to do with the making of heroes, and thus hinted for the consolation of those who don't happen to be engaged in any stupendous victories, that, had opportunity so served, they might have been heroes too. If you are not, friend, it is not your fault, whilst I don't wish to detract from any gentleman's reputation who is. There. My worst enemy can't take objection to that. The point might have been put more briefly perhaps, but, if you please, we will not argue that question. Well then, the victories which I wish especially to commemorate in this paper are the 6 great, complete, prodigious, and undeniable victories achieved by the corps which the editor of the Cornhill magazine has the honor to command. When I seemed to speak disparagingly but now of generals, it was that chief I had in my eye, if you will permit me the expression. I wished him not to be elated by too much prosperity. I warned him against assuming heroic imperatorial airs, and cocking his laurels too jauntily over his ear. I was his conscience, and stood on the splashboard of his triumph car, whispering, "Hominum memento te." As we rolled along the way, and passed the weathercocks on the temples, I saluted the symbol of the goddess Fortune with a reverent awe. "Ye have done our little endeavor," I said, bowing my head, "and mortals can do no more. But we might have fought bravely and not won. We might have cast the coin, calling, head, apostrophe and lo, tail might have come uppermost. O thou ruler of victories, thou awarder of fame, thou giver of crowns and shillings, if thou hast smiled upon us, shall we not be thankful? There is a saturnine philosopher, standing at the door of his bookshop, who, I fancy, has a poo-poo expression as the triumph passes. I can't see quite clearly for the laurels, which have fallen down over my nose. One hand is reining in the 2 white elephants that draw the car. I raise the other hand up to 2 the laurels, and pass on, waving him a graceful recognition. Up the hill of Ludgate around the Pauline Square by the side of Cheap until it reaches our own hill of Corn the procession passes. The Imperator is bowing to the people, The captains of the legions are riding round the car, their gallant minds struck by the thought, have we not fought as well as yonder fellow, swaggering in the chariot, and are we not as good as he? Granted, with all my heart, my dear lads. When your consulship arrives, may you be as fortunate. When these hands, now growing old, shall lay down sword and truncheon, may you mount the car, and ride to the temple of Jupiter. Be yours the laurel then. Nec me murdus dedicit, looking cosily down from the arbor, where I sit under the arched vine. I fancy the imperator standing on the steps of the temple erected by Titus, on the Mons Frumentarius, and addressing the citizens. Quirites, he says, in our campaign of 6 months, we have been engaged 6 times, and in each action have taken near upon 100,000 prisoners. Go to. What are other magazines compared to our magazine? Sound, trumpeter. What banner is there like that of Cornhill? You, philosopher yonder. He shirks under his mantle. Oh, you know what it is to have 110,000 readers? 100,000 readers? 100,000 buyers? Cries of, oh, ooh, s, upon my honor. H, come. And murmurs of applause and derision, say more than 100,000 purchasers and I believe as much as 1,000,000 readers. Immense sensation. Oh, these have we said an unkind word? We have enemies. Have we hit them an unkind blow? Have we sought to pursue party aims, to forward private jobs, to advance selfish schemes? The only persons to whom wittingly we have given pain are some who have volunteered for our corps, and of these volunteers we have had thousands. Murmurs and grumbles. Had commander, citizens, could place all these men, could make officers of all these men? Cries of, oh no! And laughter, old say, I accept this recruit, though he is too short for our standard, because he is poor, and has a mother at home who wants bread? Apostrophe apostrophe could enroll this other, who is too weak to bear arms, because he says, look, sir, I shall be stronger anon. Apostrophe apostrophe the leader of such an army as ours must select his men, not because they are good and virtuous, but because they are strong and capable. To these our ranks are ever open, and in addition to the warriors who surround me the generals look proudly conscious. Tell you, citizens, that I am in treaty with other and most tremendous champions, who will march by the side of our veterans to the achievement of fresh victories. Now, blow, trumpets! Bang, ye gongs! And drummers, drop the thundering skins! Generals and chiefs, we go to sacrifice to the gods! Crowned with flowers, the captains enter the temple, the other magazines walking modestly behind them. The people huzza, and, in some instances, kneel and kiss the fringes of the robes of the warriors. The philosopher puts up his shutters, and retires into his shop, deeply moved. In ancient times, Pliny, a pottsmith, relates it was the custom of the imperator to paint his whole body a bright red, and, also, on ascending the hill, to have some of the hostile chiefs led aside to the adjoining prison, and put to death. We propose to dispense with both these ceremonies. Thorns in the cushion. In the essay with which this volume commences, the Cornhill magazine was likened to a ship sailing forth on her voyage, and the captain uttered a very sincere prayer for her prosperity. The dangers of storm and rock, the vast outlay upon ship and cargo, and the certain risk of the venture, gave the chief officer a feeling of no small anxiety. For who could say from what quarter danger might arise, and how his owner's property might be imperiled? After a 6 months' voyage, we with very thankful hearts could acknowledge our good fortune. And, taking up the apologue in the roundabout manner, we composed a triumphal procession in honor of the magazine, and imagined the imperator thereof riding in a sublime car, to return thanks in the temple of victory. Cornhill is accustomed to grandeur and greatness, and has witnessed, every 9th of November, for I don't know how many centuries, a prodigious annual pageant, chariot, progress, and flourish of trumpetry, And being so very near the mansion house, I am sure the reader will understand how the idea of pageant and procession came naturally to my mind. The imagination easily supplied a gold coach, 8 cream-colored horses of your true Pegasus breed, huzzing multitudes, running footmen, and clanking knights in armor, a chaplain and a sword-bearer with a muff on his head, scowling out of the coach window, and a lord mayor all crimson, fur, gold chain, and white ribbons, solemnly occupying the place of state. A playful fancy could have carried the matter farther, could have depicted the feast in the Egyptian hall, the ministers, chief justices, and right reverend prelates taking their seats round about his lordship, the turtle and other delicious viands, and Mr. Toole behind the central throne, bawling out to the assembled guests and dignitaries, colon my lord so and so, my lord what do you call him, my lord et cetera, the lord mayor pledges you all in a loving cup. Then the noble proceedings come to an end. Lord Simper proposes the ladies. The company rises from table and adjourns to coffee and muffins. The carriages of the nobility and guests roll back to the west. The Egyptian hall, so bright just now, appears in a twilight glimmer, in which waiters are seen ransacking the dessert and rescuing the spoons. His lordship and the lady mayoress go into their private apartments. The robes are doffed, the collar and white ribbons are removed. The mayor becomes a man, and is pretty surely in a fluster about the speeches which he has just uttered, remembering too well now, wretched creature, the principal points which he didn't make when he rose to speak. He goes to bed to headache, to care, to repentance, and, I dare say, to a dose of something which his body physician has prescribed for him. And there are ever so many men in the city who fancy that man happy. Now, suppose that all through that 9th of November his lordship has had a racking rheumatism, or a toothache, let us say, during all dinner time through which he has been obliged to grin and mumble his poor old speeches. Is he enviable? Would you like to change with his lordship? Suppose that bumper which his golden footman brings him, instead ifikins of Hippocras or Canary, contains some abomination of Senna. Away! Remove the golden goblet, insidious cupbearer. You now begin to perceive the gloomy moral which I am about to draw. Last month we sang the song of glorification, and rode in the chariot of triumph. It was all very well. It was right to huzza, and be thankful, and cry, bravo, our side. And besides, you know, there was the enjoyment of thinking how pleased Brown, and Jones, and Robinson, our dear friends, would be at this announcement of success. But now that the performance is over, my good sir, just step into my private room, and see that it is not all pleasure this winning of successes. Cast your eye over those newspapers, over those letters. See what the critics say of your harmless jokes, neat little trim sentences, and pet waggeries. Why, you are no better than an idiot. You are driveling. Your powers have left you. This always overrated writer is rapidly sinking to, and see, this is not pleasant. But neither is this the point. It may be the critic is right, and the author wrong. It may be that the Archbishop's sermon is not so fine as some of those discourses 20 years ago which used to delight the faithful in Granada. Or it may be, pleasing thought, that the critic is a dullard, and does not understand what he is writing about. Everybody who has been to an exhibition has heard visitors discoursing about the pictures before their faces. One says, this is very well, another says, this is stuff and rubbish, another cries, bravo. This is a masterpiece. And each has a right to his opinion. For example, one of the pictures I admired most at the Royal Academy is by a gentleman on whom I never, to my knowledge, set eyes. This picture is No. 346, Moses, by Mr. S. Solomon. I thought it had a great intention. I thought it finely drawn and composed. It nobly represented, to my mind, the dark children of the Egyptian bondage, and suggested the touching story. My newspaper says colon two ludicrously ugly women, looking at a dingy baby, do not form a pleasing object. And so goodbye, Mr. Solomon. Are not most of our babies served so in life? And doesn't Mr. Robinson consider Mr. Brown's cherub an ugly, squalling little brat? So cheer up, Mr. S.S. It may be the critic who discoursed on your baby is a bad judge of babies. When Pharaoh's kind daughter found the child, and cherished and loved it, and took it home, and found a nurse for it too, I dare say there were grim, brick-dust-colored chamberlains, or some of the tough, old, meager, yellow princesses at court, who never had children themselves, who cried out, "Faugh, the horrid little squalling wretch," and knew he would never come to good, and said, "Didn't I tell you so?" when he assaulted the Egyptian. Never mind then, Mr. S. Solomon, I say, because a critic pooh-poohs your work of art, your Moses, your child, your foundling. Why, did? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.